Thanks very much for that, Michael. I appreciate that. And thanks, all of you, for coming here. What I want to do this evening is present a short lecture followed by a film screening of some work that I've made. But I want to begin by screening a film that I did not make, where the medium and the message get a little confusing for me. So let's see if we can make that happen.
I am an American.
I'm an American.
I am an American.
I'm an American.
I am 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 an American.
I'm an American.
I am an American.
I am
an American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
I am American.
I am America.
I'm an American.
I'm an American.
I'm an American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
I'm an American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
I am an American. Now, when I say that phrase, should I feel pride or shame? Should I feel a sense of belonging or a sense of disjuncture? I wonder always, will that statement make me friends or make me enemies? Should I say it at all? Is it an identification that I want to make? Is it an identification that I could unmake if I wanted to? If I do say it, should I qualify it? Should I say, I am a U.S. American? Or should I let the hemispheric designation America describe my citizenship? What do I mean, and what does it do when I say I am an American? And what do others think I mean and think I'm saying when I say that? Now, I want to be really clear. I am not anti-American, but neither am I a patriot. If what it means to be a patriot is to leave unquestioned the nation, its nationalisms, and what these nationalisms make possible internationally. Now, of course, you could make the contrary argument as well, though, to say that being a patriot is to question the nation, its nationalisms, and the internationalisms these make possible. So this makes me wonder, should I say instead, I am a patriotic American? To me, that sounds even weirder. And yet it's these kinds of strange conjunctions of citizenship, national identification, and patriotism, and the meanings and uses of these domestically and internationally that compel me. Not necessarily to embrace them. I don't want to run around saying I am an American, but neither do I want to eschew them. What I want to do is try to understand what they mean and what they do. So as you can imagine, when I saw that, it had my full attention. So what was that? Well, if you were U.S. in the United States 10 years ago, you probably know that that was the American Ad Council's I Am an American public service announcement. It was first broadcast on U.S. television 10 days after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. And what you saw there was a montage of U.S. citizens of various ages, races, religions, ethnicities. They're all looking directly into the camera, as I'm supposed to remember to do occasionally tonight. And they were declaring, I am an American, okay? And at the same time, there was this emotive Americana music in the background, very kind of Copeland-esque, which pulls at U.S. heartstrings. At some point, this montage was interrupted by the U.S. motto. And if you saw, it first appeared in Latin, E Pluribus Unum. And because we don't study that much Latin in the United States, it was immediately translated for us into English as out of many, one. Now, that motto originally meant out of many colonies, one federated nation. But it came to mean, over the years, out of many different kinds of U.S. Americans, one unified nation. It's a sort of melting pot ideal. The final shot of that public service announcement I find very interesting. It was a little girl. She's possibly Arab, possibly South Asian, possibly Hispanic. But she was definitely not in the U.S. imaginary and vocabulary Caucasian, okay, which meant she was able to be emblematic of difference. And she's riding her bike in Brooklyn Bridge Park, which is across the East River in New York City from where the Twin Towers used to be. So what we notice is the absence of the Twin Towers. And the final shot is of her smiling broadly, waving the U.S. flag. Now, according to the Ad Council, which is the leading producer of public service announcements in the United States, the I Am an American campaign, I'm quoting them here, helped the country to unite in the wake of the terrorist attacks by celebrating the nation's extraordinary diversity. I first saw that public service announcement about a week after it was released. I happened to be in the United States. And as soon as I saw it, it was like, oh my gosh, I have to respond to this. But I had absolutely no idea how to respond to it. Being a kind of geeky academic, I mean, Michael was very generous in his introduction, but that just adds up to being a geeky academic. My first response was to think about it analytically. So I put on all these different ways of analyzing it. I analyzed how the public service announcement functioned. I was persuaded by Evelyn Ossoltani's argument that the public service announcement was an illustration of what she calls diversity patriotism. Now, what diversity patriotism means is we have this imagined community of Americans, and then there's a moment when we allow racialized others to be temporarily incorporated into that imagined community of Americans, so much so that their difference actually stands for what it means to be American. Okay? And this is very much in line with what we think of as the American melting pot myth. I analyzed how the public service announcement functioned. How it functioned cinematically, how it used a variety of cinematic strategies to make this diversity patriotism work. And here it's the sort of geeky filmmaker where I'm looking at how you have these sharply focused, unnamed US Americans staring at the camera, and then behind them are these softly focused Americana backdrops. Some of them are very familiar to US citizens, like the Redwood Forest or the Golden Gate Bridge, but then other ones that had become emblematic and iconic during 9/11 were also included, like a fire station in Lower Manhattan. I articulated a politics in relation to the public service announcement, particularly about what troubled me about it, that it constructs the tolerance of difference as the foundation of the US nation as the US melting pot, that it presumes that melting into this melting pot is desirable and achievable for all US citizens. That its only critique of tolerance is that we're maybe not tolerant enough. We forget to be tolerant as US citizens during a crisis. But it forgets all these other kinds of critiques of tolerance, like about how the moral, about how the tolerant person claims to be morally superior and has a position of power in relation to the person they tolerate. You know, I'm better than you are, but that's okay, I'll let you live. And also how even in its own terms, the public service's announcement is itself intolerant of difference, because it excludes from its representations of meltable Americans, US citizens who can melt into this melting pot, any unambiguous markers of Arab or Muslim or Sikh or indigenous or queer Americans, suggesting somehow that they are beyond the limit of tolerance, and which makes them both a danger to the sovereign nation state, who they're out to get us, and of course, because they're out to get us possibly, they are endangered by the sovereign nation state of the United States. I even analyzed why this thing made me cry, and I have to admit it, I cried like crazy when I first saw it. Now, I had just come from a funeral, and I was at a wake. And the television was on in the corner because the war on terror was just beginning. So we were kind of like sad, even sadder. So I cried a lot. And there was, of course, a political and human context in what was going on. But there were also very sentimentalizing tricks in that public service announcement about its music, its pacing, its lighting, its focus. Now, as I do, I freely shared all of these views with my relatives and friends, my fellow US citizens, who really didn't want to hear them, but they either politely listened or argued with me, that happened a lot, or tuned me out, that happened even more, or urged me on, my mother and father and my older brother, yay. But what I did as I shared these analyses with them is I really became convinced that I wasn't going to persuade anyone with my critiques. Because one of the things that you may not know about this public service announcement, unless you're U.S., is it was like immediately dubbed an historic ad. It was dubbed as having made a major shift in U.S. society after 9/11. After 9/11, you could barely speak to a U.S. citizen who hadn't seen that public service announcement and who hadn't, like me, cried when they saw it. And so what I realized was that I wasn't going to sway these everyday US Americans who had been so moved by this public service announcement this public service announcement did two things for them. By the American Ad Council's account, it reinforced their imaginaries of the US as a tolerant melting pot. And by doing this, by my account, it justified for these US citizens why US violence should be targeted at terrorist others abroad, and also at unmeltable US Americans at home. The I Am an American public service announcement worked then because it was affective, because it made you cry, it made you feel. And it was affective because it was visual and aural, and also because, of course, its timing was incredibly, it was amazing timing, 10 days after 9/11. But what was really important about this PSA was that the PSA didn't tell US Americans what to think about their state and themselves. It used sounds and images to make US citizens feel what they thought they already knew about their state and about their relationship to that state. And so I had to think again, and I thought, well, my analyses were important because I understand how this thing works, this public service announcement works. But if I want to interrupt the imaginaries that this public service announcement circulates, because I want to interrupt the violences these imaginaries make possible, then I have to engage this public service announcement on its own terms by crafting an affective, visual, and aural response to it. And a portion of the work that I want to show you this evening comes from that project. That's my response. It comes from a project that will have a shocking title to you tonight, given my opening statement and the title of this lecture. The project's called I Am an American, Video Portraits of Post 9/11 US Citizens. The project chronicles some of the complications and paradoxes in the seemingly simple declaration, I Am an American, particularly when this declaration is meant to express citizenship, identity, tolerance, nationalism, patriotism, and justice. It does this by offering 13 short films, and don't worry, I won't show you all 13 this evening, each of which features a US citizen who found themselves on the wrong side of the Bush administration's interpretation of what it means to be and to act like a loyal and law-abiding US citizen in the aftermath of September 11. These US citizens include US soldiers who fought in Iraq and their families sometimes, US civilians who were caught up in the immigration wars, because of course, as we all know, after 9/11, the immigration wars were fought in the name of combating terrorism, and US citizens who, because of their race, religion, or political views, became what I would think of as collateral damage in the Bush administration's war on terror. Each film follows the same structure. It opens with the 9/11 call, the 911 call, the emergency call between the firefighters. So, tower number one is on fire, all firefighters need to respond. And then it opens with the title character of each of the films introducing themselves, saying what their name is, and telling their story. And this is actually very different from what you saw in the public service announcement. These are anonymous US citizens, and we have no idea what their background stories are. And it was in part the curiosity of not knowing about that that made me go out and talk to other US citizens. And by omitting those kinds of details, the public service announcement that the Ad Council put out, was able to kind of reduce the complexity of the line, I am an American, into a bunch of images and sounds that don't always add up. My films also then end with an I am an American line. I asked every US citizen I interviewed to say for me what kind of US citizen they thought they were. In response to the war on terror. And then, like the public service announcement, I interrupt their stories with the US motto, except instead of having it be E pluribus unum, I turn it around to ex uno pluris. It's not about trying to be clever. It's about trying to think about how the relationship that citizens have with their state is reversible. I mean, many people believe that the state protects the citizen so long as the citizen abides by the laws of the state. And the point I'm trying to express here is that that the law-abiding citizen's belief that their state will not use violence against them is never guaranteed. It is reversible whenever policies are reversed or whenever a crisis appears. I chose to make the films about these particular individuals for a number of reasons. I mean, certainly I hope you'll find, like I did, that many of their stories are very compelling. But more importantly, because each of these title characters bears a symbolic relationship to their times. Each has something to say about the human costs of a fear-based patriotism that has gripped the United States. Well, okay, it's often gripping the United States, but this time since 9/11. And I think that each of these films and each of these characters has something to say about the state-citizen-violence relationship. And with all of that in mind, what I also asked each of the characters in the film to do for a final shot, I asked them to pose with the U.S. flag in a way that would express their relationship to the post-9/11 U.S. state. I got some very interesting poses there. I also got some maybe even more interesting refusals to pose with the U.S. flag. If you look at these films individually, just one by one, not thinking of them as a collection of 13, they can be seen as affirming national identification and the U.S. sovereign nation state for its citizens, because each film actually offers an individual demand for the American ideals of liberty and justice for all. And maybe they mean that for all, or maybe they only mean that for themselves individually. But however they mean it, in these films, they're expressing that demand as through an expression of the demand for the tolerance of difference. I mean, it seems to me sometimes that all these different U.S. citizens want, is for themselves to be included or assimilated or melted into this imagined community of the United States that they hold so dear. And I think that's definitely true for some of the people I interviewed, probably most of them. But if you look at these films as a collection, as more than the sum of their parts, then at least to me they do something further. They expose what Barbara Johnson calls the critical difference that always exists within the one nation, one ideal of citizenship, one ideal of liberty, one collective memory of 9/11 and its aftermath. And it's this critical difference that keeps an identity from corresponding to its image of itself as whole, united, and complete. I think the collection does this because its individual visions of citizenship, tolerance, justice, patriotism, America are irreconcilable. None of the people that I interviewed have the same imaginary of the United States or of America, and none of their imaginaries actually accord with the ideal of U.S. Americanness that you see here. So in this sense, the films become a study in what Kate Nash has called filming the fear of difference. And I hope this is what makes their stories hauntologies, and their images are what Alex Danchev called hauntographies. I mean, to me, altogether, what I hope they do is they begin to combat a kind of mindless pro-Americanism as well as a mindless anti-Americanism, both of which can be used to justify national and international violence. When I finished this collection, it occurred to me that they actually spoke to a bit more than just this post-9/11 moment about what it means to be an American. There was a larger question here, which was, how do U.S. Americans engage with their inalienable right, their claimed inalienable right to liberty during the War on Terror? And when I started to think of the project in terms of this inalienable right to liberty, I was like, oh, this is a three-part project, because there are three inalienable rights that U.S. Americans claim for themselves: liberty, but also life and the pursuit of happiness. And what's also very interesting is you can see these claims that citizens make to these rights most apparently during times of crisis. So because of that, I've started to engage in a second part of the project, which asks the question, how do U.S. Americans engage with their claimed inalienable right to the pursuit of happiness during the global financial crisis? And you'll see part of that work in the loop I'll show you very shortly. One of the places this new project took me was to Zuccotti Park in New York City, where the Occupy Wall Street movement based itself. And there, of course, a new expression began to capture the imagination of U.S. citizens, first U.S. citizens, then maybe many others. We are the 99%. I began to trace how this expression, we are the 99%, has been Americanized, how it has fractured an apparent unity of America, but also how it, as it became populist, it actually enabled an alternative way of saying, I am an American. Indeed, for me, the death knell of the expression, we are the 99%, was the moment when the presidential candidate Mitt Romney, who thankfully I don't have to introduce as President-elect Romney this evening, yay, said that he understood the 99%. And I was like, okay, it's over now. We're done with that. Now, I don't have time to properly introduce the second part of that project, so I'm going to let the films that I'm going to show you this evening do that work for me. But I'll happily answer questions about that afterwards. Just a word on the loop that you're going to see. It consists of three films from the post-9/11 Liberty Project, three films from the Global Financial Crisis Pursuit of Happiness Project, one of which, only one I'm afraid this evening, is from Occupy Wall Street. And then it ends with a final clip, which is an alternative public service announcement that I made, an I Am an American public service announcement that I made, but I made it with participants from my Liberty Project. As you're watching these films or afterwards, I'd hope you take a moment to fill out these red, white, or blue comment cards that you see in front of you. And that you see, how does this work again? There we go. What these comment cards are used for is they form part of a comments flag that I use to display at exhibitions when I exhibit this work. And like the Liberty films in this project, they're all going to end up as part of the permanent collection of the September 11 Memorial Museum at Ground Zero. So when you write on your comment cards, don't write things like, great film, Cindy, or don't like your film, Cindy. Don't address them to me. Try to think about the imaginary community, the sort of future community of people who you might be able to have a dialogue with about what you think it means to say, I am an American. Okay, so at this point, I'm going to dim the lights and show that film.
Greetings, children. I'm from the Church of Stop Shopping. I'm Reverend Billy.
Amen!
Oh, it's you!
The Church of Stop Shopping started in the 90s. We're from all kinds of faith backgrounds, and we're in recovery from fundamentalism. The 1% are fundamentalists. They believe in money. And they believe that their money should rule the world. The year of 2008, the year of the bailouts, 5,000 people working in these buildings got bonuses of more than $1 million. That's our money.
Those banks have a bigger control of our economy than before the recession. Let us occupy those banks. Yeah. Amen.
We are pursuing the American dream here, but we know that the American dream that is established in the minds of many Americans by thousands of false advertisements, we know that that American dream needs to be occupied by a new American dream. It needs new language, needs new songs, needs new dancing. Amen. My ideal political system is this system right here. This is an economy. This is an attitude. This is a way of being generous. This is a way of being gentle. This is my country. I'm going to do all my business right here. In the 99% we trust, the 99%, my new God.
I am American.
I am American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
We are Americans.
I am American.
I am an American.
I am American.
He became an American.
I am
an Iraq war resistor.
A political refugee from America.
The son of an immigrant without papers.
I'm the founder of the Minutemen Civil Defense Corps.
I'm a fast-track citizen.
A peace mom.
Watch-listed Muslim American.
I am a human rights activist.
Autumn American.
Hurricane Katrina evacuees.
I am a wrongly accused terrorist spy, and I am a patriotic American.
I am American.
I am an American.
I am American.
I am.
I am.
I am.
American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
I am American.
I am.
I am.
I am.
American.
My name is Ophelia Rivas, and I'm Autumn, and I have lived in Autumn territory all my life. Not until I was much older that I realized that my territory was in two countries. My father's community is 15 miles south of the U.S.-Mexico international border. And my mother's community is just less than a quarter of a mile in Arizona on the U.S. After 9/11 in 2003, the United States government proposed to close off the entire U.S. international border, which means on the Tohono-O'odham lands, there's 74 miles of international border. This is the wall that we are opposing. With the international border militarized, we have many, many agents of the United States government in our territory doing what they call protecting the American way of life. The National Guard is in my backyard. Can you hear them? I know these border patrols come from, they're not from here. And it seems like nobody told them what the Autumn people are like. When it gets really hot like this, we'll sleep outdoors, because in the summertime, in the evening, it gets really nice and cool. And since there's been more an increase of the border patrol, sometimes they'll just come in and spotlight you. They'll drive by with these big spotlights. But we live here and we're sleeping, and they come around. We've had this problem of proof of citizenship. We don't have documents. I myself don't have a birth record. This cart's says that I'm officially enrolled as a Tohono-O'odham Nation tribal member. And this is the only form of ID that I have to prove that I exist. Our vehicle was stopped, and I was told to say that I was a U.S. citizen or a Mexican citizen. And I said I was an Autumn, and he proceeded to unclip his handgun, and he pointed it at my head and told me to say that either I was a U.S. citizen or a Mexican citizen, or he would throw me on the pavement, handcuff me, and deport me. And I said, where are you going to deport me to? Mexico is also my land. There's so many people that are so proud and so patriotic in this America and don't realize that these kind of violations still occur. We want to be proud of America, but how can we when they continue to violate our rights? All we want is someone to hear that we do live on both sides of the border and we do continue to cross that border. My nation is divided by an international border, and I'm an autumn American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
I am American.
I am.
I am.
I am.
Autumn American.
My name is Julia Ann Shearson. I'm the executive director of the Cleveland chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. That's a civil rights organization. We do media relations, educational outreach, and civil rights advocacy. I was traveling back from a weekend vacation in Canada. I had gone there with my little daughter, who's 4.5 years old. I'm a convert to Islam, and she's Arab American Muslim. As we were coming through the customs, I saw the agent scan the passports and saw on the agent's console flashing in red letters, armed and dangerous. The agent proceeded to handcuff me with my hands behind my back. I just remember seeing all these pickup trucks, you know, going through and thinking, oh yeah, you know, I used to be one of those ordinary white Americans who nobody ever paid any attention to, and now I'm something else. So when I got home, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request to get the information about why my daughter and I were stopped. Those records were very blacked out, but there was a very interesting line on them that said, pertaining to terrorism, and it said PPN-TSC, and then proceeded to give a number, and I wondered, what is that TSC number? What I have learned is that I'm on at least 3 watch lists. All I am is PPN-TSC-384-610-T92, primary 4, on the terrorist watch list. That's all I am.
Hey! How you doing?
And my daughter's on those lists.
What's going on?
So all of this is related, information related to the watch list. In the attempt to keep us safe, we're putting ourselves in a kind of prison where we put people on a list because they have unpopular ideas or they advocate for unpopular causes. It's very intimidating. We filed a lawsuit along with the Freedom of Information Act to show that these lists are in violation of the 1974 Privacy Act.
Me.
Yeah, I think you are too. Really, I'm doing that for my daughter. And so that my daughter, Dalal, never has to worry that she's going to be stopped or searched or handcuffed or questioned or frightened by government intrusion for who she is. I think you helped pick them last year, right?
Because well, I did.
I know law enforcement takes a particular interest in people who convert. And I think it's just a big mistake to think because somebody changed their religion that they somehow changed their allegiance to their country. In most cases, it's preposterous. And the American people are too busy to think about 9/11 anymore. I guess I live it every day. Handcuffing me at the border reminded me about the very precious nature of freedom. We can be safe, but we can also be free. And, you know, Patrick Henry never said, give me security or give me death. You know, he said, give me liberty. And we all deserve liberty. I am number 384610 on the terrorist watch list, and I'm an American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
I am American.
I am.
I am.
I am.
American.
Of a serious financial crisis. Our entire economy is in danger.
I'm going to ease the credit crisis and restore growth and prosperity.
Give me your head. Come here.
My name is Mary Lee Ward, and I am 82 years old. Come here, kiss your bald head. And I live at 320 Tompkins Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11216. That's 1503.
He just shined his head.
I bought this house in 1975. But I moved in this house over 40 years ago. This is my house. This whole story started about getting my great-granddaughter back into the family. She was given out into illegal adoption. I haven't seen her since she was three days old. So 2 years into the adoption, the lawyer that was handling the case said, Mary Lee, I'm going to need another $10,000 to proceed with your case with the baby. And I said, oh, what am I going to do? Where am I going to get another $10,000? Saw a flyer for loans. I went to the broker, and he says, I don't see why you can't have $10,000, Miss Ward. So I went back there. He said, well, Miss Ward, we got your money. You're going to get your baby. And I was so happy. He said, now sign these papers. I didn't look to see what I was signing. I was so happy and I was talking. The main thing that I was going to get the monies to get give the lawyer to get the baby. And finally he got through and he hands me this check. And when I was just blabbing about, and when I looked at the check, I almost passed out. The check was for $1,467.51. Papers, babe, now everything is papers. I went to the district attorney's office. I said, I don't want this. And the gentleman says, we'll write a letter that I wasn't taking the loan. I got an answer back, Delta Funding Bank, and said that they have put my application for the loan in the inactive file. Next thing I know, I got a letter stating the fact that they're foreclosed on me. I went back to the district attorney and I said, look what they did to me. They foreclosed on me. They were going to sell my house. My livelihood is my tenants for rent. But because of this, the tenants stopped paying me rent. This man here, Mr. he claims that he bought my house to an auction in June this, the 12th, 08. His lawyer. My client is suffering because Miss Ward won't pay him rent. I don't have to pay rent. Why should I pay rent for my own house? I'm the landlord. I'm the owner. He is not the owner. He doesn't know anything about inside or either outside, except to send the marshal to break my door down. On October the 4th, 2011, the marshal and 30 policemen, they broke in my iron gate just to put a notice on my house to evict me. They broke in the iron gate outside. They broke that lock and took it off. And they could still have put it on this door. Instead, they went to my bedroom door. That's what hurts me, invaded my privacy. Oh, they had no right doing this. I mean, I could see if they had a warrant, but no, it's not no warrant they had. Just for a notice. A notice.
At 82, you should not lose your house to predatory lending.
Common law and O4O got the attorney general involved. They have come to a solution that I should take a reverse mortgage since Mr. wants his money back, and then I could stay in my house, collect my rents, and the house is mine.
Housing is a human right.
I want to keep my house because I want my great-granddaughter here. This is our home. It's not just a house. This is our home.
My name is James Verone. I live in Gastonia, North Carolina. I'm 60 years old right now. I was a truck driver. What happened was I'm driving the truck down the road and I got a severe pain in my chest. And I thought I was going to die. I had no medical insurance. I could not get medical care. I was desperate. I was totally desperate. So I came up with my plan to rob a bank. When I went in, I was unarmed. I gave her this note. This is what it says. This is a bank robbery. Only give me $1 and I will sit down and wait for the police. I need medical attention. And I signed my name.
We're being robbed, please. RBC 500 South New Hope Road.
500 South New Hope Road. Can you stay on the phone with me, please?
No, ma'am. There's a guy in the lobby. I'm afraid to.
Is it being threatening to y'all?
I can't talk to you. He's real close to me.
Okay. The dog, they all went in.
Yeah, ma'am, they're here. They have him.
I only had to walk 3 steps in my cell, and I had instant medical care. If I could get over to the button on the wall, I would have a stretcher, a nurse, possibly a doctor, and guards take me to the hospital. I used to go to sleep looking at that button on the wall, and it gave me a feeling of security knowing that all I had to do was go up, get to that button, hit that button, and someone was going to be there to help me. My attorney, he said, everyone I represent is of a different nature than you are. You are trying to stay in jail. All of my other clients are trying to get out of jail. Seeing how I can't work because of my medical condition, seeing how I don't have any medical insurance to correct my medical condition, the best place for me is in jail. It's not right to walk into a bank, to break the law. Definitely not a recommended way to get medical care. But there are two things that government is responsible to do: protect us from our enemies and take care of our health and welfare. And the government does not take care of our health and welfare. Healthcare is viewed as less important as a war. People die in a war. If you're not treated medically, you die too. If a person has to rob a bank, to go to jail, to get medical care, what's this country coming to? I robbed a bank to get medical care. And I am an American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
I am American.
I am.
I am.
I am.
American.
Greetings, children. I'm from the Church of Stop Shopping. I'm Reverend Billy.
Amen.
Oh, it's you. The Church of Stop Shopping started in the 90s. We're from all kinds of faith backgrounds, and we're in recovery from fundamentalism. The 1% are fundamentalists. They believe in money. And they believe that their money should rule the world. The year of 2008, the year of the bailouts, 5,000 people working in these buildings got bonuses of more than $1 million. That's our money.
those banks have a bigger control of our economy than before the recession. Let us occupy those banks. Yeah. Amen.
Yeah. We are pursuing the American dream here, but we know that the American dream that is established in the minds of many Americans by thousands of false advertisements, we know that that American dream needs to be occupied by a new American dream. Needs new language, needs new songs, needs new dancing, amen.
Wall Street Titans state, but don't give up. Nation state, but don't have enough to live. American dream has become a nightmare, and we occupy Fort Chain. We're marching to
the
if you suffer,
if you suffer.
My ideal political system is this system right here. This is an economy. This is an attitude. This is a way of being generous. This is a way of being gentle. This is my country. I'm gonna do all my business right here. In the 99% we trust, the 99%, my new God.
I am American.
I am American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
We are Americans.
I am American.
I am an American.
I am American.
He became an American.
I am
an Iraq war resister,
a political refugee from America,
the son of a immigrant without papers,
I'm the founder of the Minutemen Civil Defense Corps.
I'm a fast-track citizen,
a peace mom,
watch-listed Muslim American.
I am a human rights activist,
autumn American,
Hurricane Katrina evacuee.
I am a wrongly accused terrorist spy, and I am a patriotic American.
I am American.
I am an American.
I am American.
I am.
I am.
I am
American.